SCR plays the oldies just like they used to be. Scratched.
Yes, welcome to SVR. It's John Barrett here, the old miserable git. I do my show now from just outside of Bridgewater, but this week I'm trying to do something a little bit different. I found when I was playing through these reel-to-reels, which I've been doing, I've got interviews on here, and these were a lot of them were done before I joined even Sid Valley Radio, but the context on them, they're, well... what can I say? They were recorded years ago on cassettes, little cassettes. Do you remember what they are? A lot of you probably don't, if you're young anyway. But I recorded these all on cassettes, and I put them onto my reel-to-reel. That made a big improvement. And so you're going to hear, well, today, just one person, because it's quite a long one. The gentleman's name was Tom Paxton. He was very kindly indulged with me. So... you're going to hear Tom Paxton interview done by me, John Barrett, and what else can I tell you about it? And then, oh yeah, that's right. Then we're going to play some Tom Paxton live because he is better live than he is recording. Sort of doing it in a studio. I think he is anyway. And this interview tells you all about that sort of thing. Tom Paxton, what should we tell you about it? No, I'll tell you what. I'll just press this button and we'll listen to the interview. And I hope you do enjoy it. Anyway, here we go. Any second now, it'll start. That's what I've got here, Tom. You were born in Chicago.
I was, 1937.
Yeah, and then you moved. And I honestly always thought you lived. Yeah, were born in Oklahoma, but in fact, you moved there.
Yeah, when I was 10, my father's sister, my aunt, lived in Oklahoma, and we would go down there on holidays, and I even spent the summer of 1945 on holiday living with my aunt in Oklahoma. So when my father's health gave way in 46-47, we moved down. He sold his business in Chicago and we moved down to Oklahoma, and unfortunately 3 months after we moved down there my father died. But there we were, so we stayed, and you know, we had family there, so it wasn't as if we were all on our own or anything.
And then you went to the university then?
I did, yes.
And what did you study?
I studied theater. I thought at that time I wanted to be an actor. Thank God I found this instead. The actor's life is even worse than the folk singer's life, if you ask me. And I took a degree in theater. I was very active. I was in 40 plays during my time there. Worked very hard at it. Enjoyed it enormously. I still love the theater. Although I have absolutely no aspirations for an acting career or anything like that. But I love the theater as an institution. I love to go. I love doing my concerts in theaters, as I'm doing tonight.
Yes.
I think theaters are great buildings.
Yes.
They have an entirely different feeling about them than, say, a town hall.
Yeah, when they're actually purpose-built.
Yeah, I love them. Yeah. I love them.
So the atmosphere's better, isn't it?
Sure. So, about the time that I finished university, I had been learning folk songs all the way through. A couple of my mates and I really loved folk songs. I had really loved folk songs my whole life without even knowing that that's what you called them. They were just songs out of the ordinary that struck my fancy. And I'd always been an admirer and enjoyer of Burl Ives singing.
Oh, yes.
He seemed to be a great repository of a certain kind of American folk music. A bit homogenized, but fine for my taste.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And but as I was in university, gradually my tastes began to broaden. I began to hear people like Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger. And finally I heard an album, a concert album of the Weavers at Carnegie Hall that absolutely, it was my epiphany. I mean, it was what knocked me to the ground on the way to Damascus. I was blinded by that album. And literally, by the time I finished hearing that album the first time through, my resolve had hardened that I had to do this.
Acting was out the window, was it?
Absolutely. Yeah. I had to do this.
Now, one thing that always amused me, I suppose, you then went in the army.
Had to.
I was just going to...
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't
an option.
No. It was. I mean, I know sort of later years we had the Vietnam.
Had national services at that time. We had the draft, and there were options one can pursue, and mine was to join the reserves and to do 6 months active duty.
I
was in the reserves for a long time. But there certainly was not an option.
I see. Yeah, basically every young man at that time did nationals. We had it in this country as well.
I know.
Yes. And from there, you got to New York.
Yeah, I was in the army. The army actually brought me to New York. I was stationed in two different posts outside New York, and I would come into New York on weekends. A couple of my university pals were living in New York, and I slept on their sofas on weekends and kind of haunted the coffee houses in Greenwich Village and gradually made friends there. And I even worked on some of the weekends while I was in the army. Someone would fail to show up for work, and they'd say, "Would you like to work tonight?" So I would, you know, and make a big, you know, $10 or something like that.
Where did you learn to play your guitar, actually? Was this from childhood?
No. My first string instrument was ukulele.
Oh, yeah.
I went to junior high school church camp one year, Presbyterian church camp, and a few people had ukuleles there, and I thought, they were wonderful with playing "Yes, Sir, That's My Baby" and "Ain't She Sweet," you know, and I thought that was marvelous. 5 foot two, eyes of blue. And so I thought these were ace songs, you know. Absolutely. So I actually got a ukulele, and I could thump away at it, and I loved it. And then it got accidentally destroyed. And the summer of my 16th year, an aunt in Chicago gave me an old guitar that was in the back of the closet, and it was just this side of unplayable. I mean, the action was very high. But I was able to play a little bit on it, and the first four strings are the same as the ukulele.
Yes,
and so gradually, I've spent actually the last the following 35 years or so incorporating the other two strings into my style. And some say inadequately, but then I was getting well and truly hooked on that. I learned to play The Streets of Laredo and The Fox Went Out on a Chilly Night. On that thing in the key of C. And my main problem at that point was that there were no books that would teach you simple folk song chords and things. The only books you could find were like for jazz kind of guitar and
rather than specialist guitar.
Yes, they had nothing to do with the kind of music I wanted to play, so it was difficult to find any kind of books. Now, of course, there are just a wealth of books. And also, the guitar was hard to play, but I thumped along on that kind of desultorily, with no great method, for a couple of years. And then, I think it was my second year in college, I asked for and received a secondhand Gibson guitar for Christmas. And I mean, we knew so little about guitars and everything that I strung it with nylon strings.
Yeah.
You know, but it sounded quite nice, but I mean, it was absolutely the wrong strings. Didn't matter, you know, you learned a little bit,
That's right.
And then I traded that guitar for an older guitar, which wasn't as good, actually. Just looked nice.
Yes.
And I went through several different guitars before I finally settled on a Martin guitar, and I've actually played nothing but Martins ever since then.
Mm-hmm. I see. So, now you're at Greenwich Village, I got down here, you actually made an LP there.
I did, yes.
Which, I mean, must be quite a rare one. Because
you may have heard me talk about the Gaslight Cafe, Greenwich Village. And it was owned during its golden years by a family, by Mr. Clarence Hood, who was beloved of us all. And he, in his first flush of enthusiasm when he bought the place, he was a businessman from Mississippi, for Pete's sake. I mean, of all the weird places for him to wind up, but there he was, and he actually kind of, his son-in-law bought the place and was too tied up in other stuff to do, so he came in and to do his son-in-law a favor and ran the place and did a very good job of it. In the afternoon, I think we recorded a couple sets and put it out. It's a monaural album. Mm-hmm. It's called I'm the Man That Built the Bridges, after one of my songs. Mm-hmm. And it's not a bad record. I mean, I've heard it recently. I have, I think, just one or two copies of it myself.
It must be quite a collector's item.
Well, I think they only pressed 2,000 copies,
yes.
So I suppose it would be something.
I don't think it ever came to these shores.
Nah, never.
No. Because the first, that goes on really to the first LP was Rambling Boy.
It was.
Over here, anyway,
mm-hmm.
It must have been for you.
Well, that's the first official.
Yes.
Official album, yeah.
Yeah, which has sort of got some of those you still play now, I imagine.
Yeah, you know, it's 25 years now since that album came out?
Yes.
This year?
Yes.
When I get home, I'm going to arrange to bring that album out on my own label. I have a company now that I've been putting out children's music on, but I'm going to set up another division of my company to re-release some of my old albums, and that's going to be the first one I'm going to do since it is 25 years.
Yeah, indeed. You can get the tapes from Elektra with no problem.
Yeah, but they all belong to Warner.
Oh,
yeah. And I can lease them.
Yes.
I mean, they won't sell them to me, but they'll lease them to me, so it's the same thing.
Mm. Again, you did Rambling Boy, Ain't That News, and Outward Bound. The first three LPs
are
very similar, really, in sort of style, aren't
they?
You know, they're very basic folky.
Sure,
thing.
Sure.
And then all of a sudden, we come to Morning Again.
Ba-bam!
You know,
yeah.
Which is,
what happened there was Paul Rothschild was my producer for the first three albums. He was a staff producer at Elektra. But then, at about that point, he suddenly was... Elektra was beginning to open up into some rock doors and things like that, and so Paul was now producing people like The Doors and Clear Light and other things like that, and he was spending more and more time in California. So there was a meeting one day, and up at Elektra, I didn't know what it was all about, but he said, listen, he just wanted to talk to me, that he was sorry to say he was not going to be able to produce my next album because of all these things that he was now being asked to do in California with The Doors, et cetera, et cetera. And they represented great opportunities for him, and he knew I would understand that, and of course I did. I hated to see him go, but he brought in Peter K. Siegel, who was a protege of his. And Peter was kind of your prototypical hippie who nevertheless would get his work done.
Yes.
You know, but he certainly had the...
Laid back,
and the beads and incense frame of mind about things. Very adventurous man, very experimental guy. So he kind of influenced me to try some things on Morning Again. Mm-hmm. And by and large, when I hear them again, I think they were successful. I think it was good for me. It opened me up a little bit. Tried a few different kinds of sounds and. Some of it, I think, really kind of worked. You know, like, let me see, Clarissa Jones, I think, was a very good track on there. It kind of swung out a little bit, but then the song kind of calls for it.
Mm.
So, I don't know, it was fun to do that work that I did with Peter.
Yes, because, I mean, I was buying your records by then, and Sunday Morning Again came out. It was so different, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I will be honest, I think I preferred that, you know, in its own, at the time, especially, because it was a generation almost, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, because the next one, wasn't it, again, Things I Notice Now, was a very similar sort of thing.
It was.
The Iron Man on that, haven't you?
Yeah.
Which is sort of a 15-minute epic, and if we don't make this last long enough, we'll play that one.
Yeah, right.
You know, I mean, that was a great departure, the Iron Man, wasn't it? What was it?
Iron Man was written in response to a request of a friend of mine, a man named Max Polakoff, who was a much older man, a kind of a wonderful session violinist in New York, played on every session imaginable, was a little pixie. He was constantly stirring things up. He used to run every year a series of concerts about new music. He was always looking for new music and encouraging new music. And I mean, most of which I have no use for, but Max was a great kind of experimenting guy. And he said to me one day, he says, I'd like to have you do something for my next, new music thing. And I said, well, Max, I don't write.
No.
He says, no, just write what you write. Write the way you write. Write something for me for that. I said, okay, I'll write, five or six songs. And then I thought, the more I thought about it, I thought, well, what a cop-out that would be. I mean, I'd write five or six songs anyhow, but here he is, he's asking me to stretch out a little bit. So I'll try writing a song cycle. I've never conceived of such a thing, but I'll do it. And I had just read a book by C.S. Forrester called The General. Wonderful book, not one of his better-known books, but it felt to me as if it were kind of a biography in fiction of Douglas Haig, was that his first name? The Haig, the World War General, who was such a monster of
drive them on.
Oh yeah, just send these poor buggers into machine guns so I conceived. I began to ask myself, where did he come from, this guy? First of all, I'm going to start with that. This is the way he finishes up. That he is a Haig kind of general, but then I wanted to go back and trace his kind of psychological. Now, I was a young writer when I did this. I don't think it's terribly successful. I mean, but I used flashbacks in it.
Yes.
which were, I wanted to write them in different styles from the narrative, and I wanted them to be more psychological than narrative, and I think people haven't really understood exactly what I was trying to do, and I accept the blame for that. I think I should have been a little clearer, perhaps, but I give myself marks for trying. You know, to stretch out a little bit on that. I'm glad I did it.
Did it take long to do that one track? Because, I mean, for 15 minutes...
Would you believe it? We did it in two takes.
Did you really?
We did. As a matter of fact, we did it in one take with one interruption.
Yeah.
One take with an interruption. We had to start a little section over again, but then we went through it. That was one of the first... That was the first arrangement that my piano player, David Horowitz, did. First arrangement of that kind that he ever did. He's now an extremely successful orchestrator of themes and things, and composer of themes for commercial adverts for television at home. I mean, he's won every conceivable award for it. But that was his first one, and we had some very heavy guys on that session. We had Hubert Laws, the jazz flautist, is the flute on that thing.
And in fact, David, at the time, was he touring with you by
then? Yeah, well, that was at the beginning of our association, was at about that time.
Because I saw you about 68 and 69, I'm guessing, which years in Bristol. I saw you, I think, 2 years after the trial.
Well, he started after Morning Again, before...
Things I
Noticed. Yeah, Things I Noticed Now was the first album we did together.
Yes, I see. And then you went into what was just called the Sixth Album, wasn't it? Crazy John, probably the most famous one, wasn't it?
Oh, I wouldn't think so. I think Whose Garden Was This would be more famous from that than Andy's Gonna Sing Her Song, Forest Lawn, Jimmy Newman,
probably, yes.
Yeah.
I suppose Crazy John, for us in Britain, perhaps more, because of the John Lennon connection.
It was such fun. I met him at the Isle of Wight. Bob Dylan introduced him to me. And he said, John, I want you to meet Tom Paxton. John said, oh, Crazy John. He had heard the song. He liked the song.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I imagine, Tom, you did a live one, a double one for Elektra, which was that basically to finish the contract?
It was, but all agreed that it was time I did a live album. I never had done one, except the Gaslight album.
Yeah.
And it was a way to finish the contract. With honor.
Yes. Yeah. And then you did How Comes the Sun, wasn't it? And that was still done in America.
Part of it was done over here.
Was it?
Yeah, I think about half of it was done in Chelsea.
I see. Because then we sort of come to you like your English phase, don't you, almost? You know, you did, what was it, Peace Will Come LP. Which
All done here, yeah.
And New Songs for Old Friends.
Yes.
I mean, those were good LPs, I thought.
Anyway. Right.
I mean, they bear listening to
them. Yeah, and then the Slough of Despond.
Well, I can't argue.
Absolutely.
We all have our peaks and our troughs.
No, those were very, very bad times for me, although they didn't feel that bad at the time, but they really were awful. I mean, I did a couple albums then that I would love to take back. Actually, the Something in My Life...
That's not so bad.
It's not as bad as...
Saturday Night.
Saturday Night's an abomination, Something in My Life is a sad album because it's not that bad. It's a terrible album because of the way my voice was compressed and the way it was mixed.
I see.
I mean, it sounds as if I'm singing through cotton wool.
Yeah.
There's some quite nice songs on there, and I was singing them as well as I could. And I think if that thing had been properly mixed, properly recorded, it would have been okay. It would have slipped by, you know. It never would have been a great album, but it wouldn't be the bad album it is. But at that time, there was a great deal of unrest in my life, a lot of unhappiness, and a lot of depression, and I was looking for direction. Now, I don't know why I'm in my direction. There's directions very obvious if I see it, but I didn't see it at that point. And my management over here... suggested that what I needed to do was get... I mean, it's the old dodge. What we need to do is get to a broader audience.
Yeah.
Who says you need to get to a broader audience? But I bought that. I mean, the buck stops here.
Yeah.
I said, okay, let's do an album that'll, you know, with a broader appeal. So we got a pop song producer. We don't even have to mention names. I mean, I'm not here to put anybody down. But it was a catastrophic mix. I mean, on that album, I wound up not even playing the guitar on it. I mean, I just sang my songs, and I was here for like 3 days and did this thing and was gone. And it is a really sad album. When I hear that thing, when I heard it, when the tape came to me in America, actually it had the effect of clearing the air for me. I thought, well, that, by God, is there. I'm never making another album again that I'm not in total charge of, that I don't understand what I'm doing. And I haven't. Everything I've done since then no compromise necessary, you know. Furthermore, it had the disadvantage or the unhappy effect of putting me right off using any other kind of instruments except folk instruments for a while. Yes. And I'm only just now coming back to the point where I think, well, I think I might like to try something else. So now I'm thinking of doing a love song album. I've only written one or two songs that would go for it, and doing it in Nashville.
That's funny, because I was going to comment on that, is the fact that your later LPs have got a lot more, we'll call them political comments or satire comments, haven't they? The love songs have vanished somewhat.
Well, now, hang on a second. Right, on a second. There's Even a Grey Day.
Yes, the LP. Yes.
That's almost all love songs.
Even a Grey Day, a lot of them are old tracks, aren't they?
You know, yeah, but then there's And Loving You. Have you heard that? Mm-hmm. That's a few old tracks, re-recorded, but new songs.
I'm probably thinking of ones like the 1 Million Lawyers LP, the Bulletin LP.
1 Million Lawyers is the biggest selling album I have had in so long, it's hard to believe. It's over 30,000.
Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Which for a folk album is, I mean, triple platinum or something.
Yes, indeed, yeah. Yeah.
Not that anyone's given me any platinum records, but...
No.
Now, see, here's the curious thing. That they 1 Million Lawyers is a huge seller for me, very popular, and yet I am finding in my concerts that the people really, they like a few funny songs, but what they're really there for is to hear the gentle songs, the quiet songs, or something like Jimmy Newman. I've just kind of put Jimmy Newman back into the show on this tour, and, oh, it's going to storm.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, especially perhaps over here, a lot of the political ones, you, which I think is quite right, you only do your political about America. You don't involve British politics, which is, I think absolutely right. But because of that, it's lost on us over here a bit, isn't it? And it can go out of date quickly, can't it?
Well, let me think. Yeah. In the political side, the satirical side that I'm doing over here, one is Republic Airlines, which anyone can understand.
Yes.
All I do about Republic Airlines here that I don't do in the States is I have just a little added piece of the patter to set up the Braniff Airlines closer, because they might not know about Braniff Airlines being a bankrupt mess.
I see.
So I kind of set that up. It's a little awkward to do it, but I've kind of figured out a way to do it. Then I do The Day We Lost the America's Cup, which is easily assimilated here. And I've been doing Yuppies in the Sky.
Mm-hmm.
And a few years ago, my agent, John Martin, said, no, that won't go here. And I said, John, I'm going to do it. And every year that goes by, it becomes better appreciated here. And, of course, Not Tonight, Marie. And that's as British as it is American, I'm sure.
And that's come from a long time
But that's
back,
about it for the funny songs. Yes. I have the lighthearted things about, you know, Jennifer and Katie and the bottle of wine, things that John Hurt.
Yeah. Just go on slightly then. I obviously would have thought Woody Guthrie was probably your biggest influence.
No question about it.
Yeah.
No
Did
question.
Did you want to meet him?
No. I had the opportunity, and I declined. Bob Dylan was going out to see him at the hospital every couple of days, and he asked me if I wanted to go. And I thought about it, and I said, no, I think not, you know, because the shape the guy is in, it really would be an intrusion for me to come in, you know. What does he need, another person to come in and see him in this condition? You know, you're going out to see him all the time, you're friends with him, and I can, you know, I value that, but I think I'll pass, and I don't regret it.
No.
You know, it would have been...
It would have been sort of just a fun to see him. Other major influences, perhaps?
Many. So many. so many that it's difficult sometimes to see. I think actually there are two major influences that perhaps wouldn't immediately occur to people. As a matter of fact, it was years before I realized what an enormous influence Tom Lehrer had been on me.
Yes.
Enormous. I mean, I always fell about singing Rickety Tickety Tin. One of the first, you know, one of my earliest songs I learned to sing, Rickety Tickety Tin, in my shows. And Jacques Brel.
Yeah.
Tremendous influence. When you listen to Jimmy Newman. Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah.
There are others, less well known, like now that I've taken my...
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, thanks for indeed that.
I think that I'm attracted to that kind of songwriting, that kind of performing. There is a, I hope it doesn't sound too pompous, there is a seriousness about it that appeals to me a lot.
Yeah. It can strike home with it, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Yes.
You know, that this is a serious song. I'm treating it seriously without solemnity.
Yes.
And my God, the Europeans seem to be able to pull that off much better than the British or the Americans, I think.
Really? Yeah.
The kind of chanson sort of thing, little dramas. So it was really in that spirit that I wrote Jimmy Newman, and it works like a charm, you know. If you give in to it and let yourself start with something small and let it build. I mean, you can't do it artificially.
No.
It's got to genuinely build from verse to verse. It's got to build in emotional contact content as well. But it's worth it.
Yes, you get a good feeling from it.
Well, you get a little catharsis out of it.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. Greenwich Village. Now and then, I've sort of asked the question: what's it like now compared to then?
Well,
do you ever go back?
The first thing you hear when you come to Greenwich Village, the first words that anyone says to you after you've struck up an acquaintance is, "Greenwich Village is gone to hell. It used to be great. It's gone to hell." I mean, I heard that in 1960 on my first weekend in New York. Greenwich Village, God, it was great. It used to be great, man. You know, the beat generation thing. And sure as hell, I mean, you go there now, first thing you're going to hear is, "God, you should have been here in the 60s. Man, it was great." Or, "You should have been here in the 70s.
Yeah.
Or, "Should have been here in the 83, man. It was really happening. It was. But now, nah, it's awful." In fact, it doesn't change. I mean, this building goes up, that building goes down, this cafe closes, another one opens. Right now, there are very few places to play. Next year, there'll be more places to play. You see, it's...
It does rotate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The analogy with Soho, I think, is not a very good one. It is not really so much like Soho.
Soho's rather sleazy.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's more of a... If you would kind of combine a bit of King's Road with a bit of Hampstead.
I see, yes.
Something like that.
Yeah.
And then actually take King's Road and Hampstead and put them in a slum.
Yeah, yep.
Which is what it is. It's all tenement buildings. Third or fourth generation Italian immigrant families living in them. So it's a real... amalgam.
And do you play there occasionally still?
Yes, I do. I play in a club on the fringes of Greenwich Village. I mean, it's over... New York University is in Greenwich Village, and the club where I play is kind of right by New York University. And it's not over on McDougal Street, where I used to play, or Bleecker Street.
No.
But it's a big club, one of the best, called The Bottom Line.
Oh, yes.
Oh, it's a wonderful place. 400 seats, state-of-the-art sound and lights, great staff. Good place to play.
What have I got down? Up, completely up to date. One of your songs you did, I think it was on the second LP over here, was Goodman, Schwartzner and Shaney.
Yeah.
You know, the, and of course, there's
Goodman, Schwartzner and Shaney.
Schwartzner and Shaney. That's, of course, been made into a film. Well,
it's been made into
Mississippi Burning.
It's been
it?
Fictionalized.
Yes. I haven't seen it. Have you?
Well,
seen
I won't see it. No.
No.
I have a thing about that movie. I wanted to see it until I learned more about it, and I'm not going to go see a movie that portrays FBI agents as heroes in Mississippi in 1964. Just it wasn't that way at all. As often as not, the FBI were in collusion with the redneck cops.
Yes, yes.
They were no help. They were J. Edgar Hoover was against the civil rights movement. So I'm not going to see that movie. I think the movie's a lie.
Yeah.
And in the movie, apparently, from everyone who's reported to me, There are no courageous blacks. They're just cringing blacks who need the help of these heroic FBI agents. Yes. And the hell with it. I mean, the bravest people down there were young black kids who were taking other blacks to get them registered to vote.
Yep.
No, I'm not going to see it.
No, fair enough.
Hell with it.
Yep. I've got recording and performing. You've really always come over better as a performer. If one's honest, I expect you will agree.
Well, it always hurts to hear that because, I mean, I certainly put my strongest efforts into recording. I think I'm being penalized for being a good performer. I like to think that I'm adequate at everything I do, that I'm good at everything I do. I think I've made some lovely records. I think I'm making some lovely records now. I'm working with good people. I started my own company to put out records for children. And they, by the way, we use a lot of instruments on them by use of emulators.
Oh, yes.
And because children's records are not folk records, they need more orchestration to them. So
I'm not going to agree that I don't.
Well, I have to. It's not. Yeah, it's
else.
Not my judgment
no.
call.
As you say,
I know most people. I'm just wondering whether it's become like conventional wisdom that I'm better in person than that people tend to. Take that as writ.
Mm, yes.
Maybe people might be persuaded to go listen to the records again and find that they're better than they thought they were.
They are not. Yes, I'm not questioning your record at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. I suppose it's a fault for you in that respect that you can make a big hall, you can make it intimate, and I suppose that creates such a wonderful illusion of closeness, doesn't it? Which probably makes people think that's
sure.
You. Yeah.
Well, of course, I mean, when you're listening to a record, you can't see, and it isn't the same. Even a live record is not the same, And I've done quite a few live records, and I just had a brand new one come out at home called Politics. That we did. I think it's about on the disc. It's about an hour and 5 minutes long, and it was absolutely magic.
Yeah.
The only thing that's been cut out of that hour and 5 minutes were a couple of ums and ers.
Yes.
Everything else,
yeah.
Everything else is left in there. It's the performance, uncut from start to last. And now maybe I'm sure that the people who were there. Well, buy the disc and say, well, the performance was better. I don't know why.
Yeah. It's an illusion.
I mean, it's not as if I'm, this handsome brute or anything with this overwhelming charisma. I don't know what the hell it is. I know that I like to perform. I hate to travel, but I like to perform. And I believe in what I do. It is, to me, it's a calling. It's my job.
Yeah.
I get paid for doing this. This is how I support myself and my family. But I'd be lying if I didn't say it was more than that.
Yeah. On performing, Rolf McTell at one stage just couldn't play Streets of London anymore.
Yeah.
Have you ever got to the stage where you can't play The Last Thing on My Mind?
Never. Never. And I read in the Riot Act about that, too. I said, listen here, babe. You're a professional. You've got an important song that you wrote, and people come and they pay money to come hear you, and part of the deal is they want to hear that song, and you've got no right. I have no right. Let me get off Ralph's case for a second.
Sure. Yes.
Let me put it this way. I have no right not to sing that song. I think there are other songs of mine which if I didn't sing, people would be disappointed. They don't have to worry, I'm going to sing them.
Yeah.
But if I didn't sing The Last Thing on My Mind, I think it would be...
It would be a Tom Paxton.
It would be a break of faith. It would be it really would not be... It wouldn't be the right thing to do.
No.
And I can tell you that if there comes a night, and it never has, but if there comes a night when I don't feel like singing the song, I will sing the song.
Yes, yeah, so that's what made me wonder, really.
Damn right.
Yeah, fair enough. This tour and the audiences, how well is it going, Tom?
Extremely well.
One more to go? Tomorrow?
Yeah, tomorrow night, that's it, and then I'm home. It really has gone well. Audiences have with a few exceptions, have been really quite adequate. The hall manager has been very pleased. And last night, I don't know, I have no idea what it'll be tonight, but we had 700 people last night in Wolverhampton.
Yes.
And, they were clicking their heels with happiness over that.
Right.
And, well, I think part of the reason is because I've got this chart-smashing album right now. That's,
the only one I haven't got. No,
it's the compilation thing, you know. The singer in the song. You didn't know about that?
No.
Oh, it's one of these compilation albums called The Singer in the Song, and Ralph's on it, and they've got my recording of Last Thing in My Mind from the Elektra double album.
Oh yes.
And Elton John and Joni Mitchell. It got to number 5 in the compilation charts.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I was heard to say that if it went up one more spot, I was going to trash a hotel room.
You really felt big time.
Yeah. Ralph and I were figuring out who we're going to stop talking to now that we're back on top.
Right,
you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's just the future, really. What do you envisage in the future? Recording?
Tons of stuff. I've got more on my plate now than I ever had. I'm writing books for children, which is something new. I took 10 Aesop's fables and turned them into verse. And that's out as a book in the States, and volume 2 of that will be out this year. Jennifer's Rabbit came out as a children's book. And I'm working on volume 3 of Aesop right now. Engelbert the Elephant's being done as a children's book, and so I'm working on a sequel to Engelbert the Elephant, also in verse, to as a book. I'm recording another album of my new children's songs in September for my own company. And I'm kind of forming the next, as I said, love song album. Yeah. I think I might do in Nashville. Mm-hmm. Not a straight country, but with, you know, some kind of a feel to it. I'm not sure yet. I'm kind of working my way into that right now. Plus, I'll continue to work on another album of political songs, or maybe not so political, it's just commentary.
Right.
Yeah, just
the way
I see it kind of things.
Lovely. Thanks very much indeed. Could you just say hello to Kate? We have a daughter called Kate. And she's, every time she hears you sing,
yeah.
Kate, she's like,
hey, Kate, I just want to tell you that I actually wrote that song for you. You, in fact, are the Kate with the little lady, and I love her.
Thanks, mate.
Okay.
Love it. All right, Sue.
Can you turn it off, please?
Yeah, could you just sign a couple things?
Oh, absolutely.
Right. No problem. Because let's see what we've got.
Yeah,
I
thought I could have brought an album.
That
couldn't
have been easier, probably. Yeah, it won't matter. I'll come down and see you back. I knew you'd bring something up, so I knew what was on there. That was the main thing.
Right.
So, that music there, which was Waltzing for Dreamers, is sung and played by Ken Watkins. Now, Ken may seem a strange name to
you. I think we've got a bit of a mishap here. Yes, Tom Paxton on again now. That's my reel-to-reel. Now, this is a live recording of Tom Paxton. And this would be the vinyl part of the day.
Clarissa Jones got bit on the heel by a rat and she hit it with a broom. He ran to the corner and stood there grinning like he owned the goddamn room. Clarissa Jones threw an iron at the rat and the rat just seemed to say fine. Twitched his tail in the corner and said, you gotta go to sleep sometime. Clarissa Jones's kid, age 16, hated his heavy old shoes. He wanna find strides like the studs on the street and they'd know he'd been paying his dues. Clarissa Jones's kid got busted, she was 3 days and getting the news. They gave him a shower, a meal, and a uniform and 2 old heavy shoes. Clarissa Jones, where are you going? It's cold and the wind is blowing through your bones. And where is your man, Clarissa Jones? Clarissa Jones carried bedpans, swept up chain sheets and mopped the hall. Doctor said she was a very good worker, Clarissa Jones knew them all. Now Clarissa Lisa Jones sits in her window with the paper reading how they burn the next street flat. She's reading about the trouble she ought to write a letter saying, hey, it never happened like that. But Lisa Jones, where are you going? It's cold and the wind is blowing through your bones. Where is your man? For Lisa Jones. William Hawkins rose early, shaved us carefully and drank his tea. He hit the desk at 9 with thanks to the Board of Opportunity. On his very first day, his boss went to great lengths to make him feel at home. And his first assignment was to dispossess some Miss Clarissa Jones. Clarissa Jones, where are you going? It's cold and the wind is blowing through your bones. And where is your man? Clarissa Jones. Where is your man, Clarissa Jones?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you and good evening. Glad you could come tonight. As you may have noticed from all the gear, all the microphones, and the huge truck parked outside, we are making what is euphemistically known as a live recording. So this is your chance for recording history. Shout, cheer. You may even boo, but it'll be clipped in the editing room and never heard. Only the positive side of life is reflected on live recording.
Rained again last night. Streets slowly drying. Sunlight's not too bright. I don't believe it's trying. I never used to care. It wouldn't cross my mind. You'd be surprised the things I noticed now. Mailman's overdue. Man upstairs is typing. My neighbor has the flu. I can hear his wife and she's griping. I never used to care. It wouldn't cross my mind. You'd be surprised the things I notice now. I'm sitting in my window seat, just watching my day walk by. There's a lot of people I should meet. If I could find a reason why. There's a whole lot of things I gotta get up and do. Like finding you. Morning streets are jammed. Taxi driver is swearing. I think his rage is sham. He looks like he's past caring. I never used to care. It wouldn't cross my mind. You'd be surprised the things I notice now. I'm gonna get myself in line. I'm gonna get a hold on things. I'm probably gonna be just fine. We'll see what tomorrow brings. There's a whole lot of things I gotta get up and do. Like finding you. Rained again last night. The streets are slowly drying. Sunlight's not too bright. I don't believe it's trying. I never used to care. It wouldn't cross my mind. You'd be surprised at the things I notice now.
Thank you very much. I'd like to do two songs for you now. One for my daughter And one for my wife. Jennifer slept in her little bed with dreams of a rabbit in her little head. Jennifer's rabbit, brown and white, left the house and ran away one night, along with a turtle and a kangaroo and 17 monkeys from the city zoo. And Jennifer too. They ran through the forest and they all held hands. They came to the ocean with the cookie crumbs hands. Called it the sea of the very best dreams. And they all built a castle of the best moonbeams and Milky Way streams. And there on the sands where the starfish play, the ship sailed in from the moonbeam bay. They all went sailing on the starlight sea, where they all had cookies with oolong tea. And Jenny had three. They danced on the decks of the red sail brig. The monkeys and the sailors did a whirling jig. Turtle played the fiddle and the rabbit played kazoo. And they bowed to each other as polite folks do. And Jenny bowed too. Then, my, said the turtle, as the clock struck three, the hour is growing very late for me. Not at all, said the rabbit, and I tell you why. We still haven't counted every star in the sky. Said Jenny, let's try. So they counted on the ship, and they counted on the shore. They counted through the forest to the bedroom door. They counted in bed till they could count no more. Then they all fell asleep, and the final score was 1,000,000,004. Yes, the rabbit and the turtle and the kangaroo, and Jenny fell asleep as sleepy folks do, just like you. Ever again the morning creeps across your shoulder, through the frosted windowpane the sun grows bolder. Your hair flows down your pillow, you're still sleeping. I think I'll wake you now and hold you, tell you again the things I told you. I give you the morning, I give you the day. Through the waving curtain wall, the sun is streaming. Far behind your flickering eyelids, you're still dreaming. You're dreaming of the good times and you're smiling. I think I'll wake you now and hold you, tell you again the things I told you. Behold, I give you the morning, I give you the day. Close beneath our windowsill, the earth is humming like an eager Christmas child, the day is coming. Listen to the morning song, it's singing. I think I'll wake you now and hold you, tell you again the things I told you. Behold, I give you the morning, I give you the day. Ballroom fan, your eyelids flutter. Sunlight streams across your eyes through open shutters. Now I think you're ready for the journey. I think I'll wake you now and hold you, tell you again the things I told you. Behold, I give you the morning, I give you the day. Behold, I give you the morning, I give you the day.
Thank you.
Thank you. Try this with us. It went zip when it moved and pop when it stopped and whirr when it stood still. I never knew just what it was and I guess I never would. That's not bad, not bad. It could be better. Perhaps if I told you how this children's song came to exist, you would be repelled into singing. You'd be propelled into singing. This song was written under the strangest imaginable circumstances for a children's song. It was written while I was doing some graduate work in a place called Fort Dix, New Jersey. You've heard of it. As one of the intellectuals in the Army, I was located in the clerk typist school there, where I was learning to be a clerk typist. And included in our esoteric curriculum was a mandatory typing class, 2 hours a day, 4 days a week, from which there was no escape. It mattered not how well you could type. When you joined the Army, you had to your name could be Smith Corona. You had to take this typing class. And then after 2 weeks, they gave us a test, and those of us who did better than 50 words a minute were excused from doing the quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog. And we were not, as you might imagine, released for more productive labors. No, instead we could sit and rot at our typewriters. They did say, however, that we could kill time by writing letters home and keeping our skills polished. And that sounded like a good idea for about a day and a half until I suddenly realized I had written to everyone I ever knew in my life and still had an hour to go. So to keep a grip on the old sanity, I made up this song on the typewriter. And I must admit, I was a little puzzled after I wrote it. Why? Under those circumstances, I had written not a bitter anti-military expose tract, but a children's song. The only explanation I could come up with was that I had been subconsciously reflecting the prevailing emotional climate of the barracks. But unfortunately, this rather glib explanation doesn't hold any water because the song answered no needs in the barracks. It was a flop. No one liked it in the barracks, and I became bitter, it being my first song to have it so crudely rejected. And so it was a great deal of satisfaction a few years later that I saw the song recorded by the Chad Mitchell Trio, and it sold thousands of copies. And it's been number one in France at one time or another, been recorded by Peter, Paul, and Mary, and I took all this money. And last week, I bought Fort Dix. I haven't decided what to do with it yet. I used to make suggestions while I was there what they could do with Fort Dix, but they were physiological impossibilities. So I think maybe I'll try some experimental farming there. Anyhow, I want you to help me sing the song. It's called The Marvelous Toy. It went zip when it moved and bop when it stopped and whirr when it stood still. I never knew just what it was, and I guess I never will. When I was just a wee little lad, full of health and joy, my father homeward came one night and gave to me a toy. A wonder to behold it was, with many colors bright. The moment I laid eyes on it, it became my heart's delight. It went zip when it moved and bop when it stopped and whirr when it stood still. I never knew just what it was, and I guess I never will. The first time that I picked it up, I had a big surprise. But right on its bottom were two big buttons that looked like big green eyes. I first pushed one and then the other, then I twisted its lid. When I set it down again, this is what it did. It went zip when it moved and bop when it stopped and whirr when it stood still. I never knew just what it was, and I guess I never will. It first marched left, then marched right, then marched under a chair. When I looked where it had gone, it wasn't even there. I started to cry and my daddy laughed, for he knew that I would find. When it turned around, my marvelous toy, chugging from behind. It went zip when it moved and bop when it stopped and whirr when it stood still. I never knew just what it was, and I guess I never will.
Well, the years have gone by too quickly, it seems. I have my own little boy. And yesterday I gave to him a marvelous little toy. His eyes nearly popped right out of his head. He gave a squeal of glee. Neither one of us knows just what it is, but he loves it just like me. It still goes zip when it moves, and bop when it stops, and whirr when it stands still. I never knew just what it was, and I guess I never will. Thank you very much. Thank you. With a dark and rolling sea between my true love and me, I keep walking through this cold, hard town. While I wait for better days, I could use a place to stay, or a floor where I could lay my blanket down. If I could beg, steal, or borrow a ticket on some ship or plane, I'd be leaving London tomorrow to fly to my own love again. Up at dawn to change my shirt and to wash away the dirt, then it's over to American Express. Not one letter did I find, no, she didn't send one line, although I know she has my forwarding address. If I could beg, steal, or borrow a ticket on some ship or plane, I'd be leaving London to my own love again. Last night the troubadour was so full they barred the door, and I sang a song she knows quite well. But it wouldn't take too long to make up another song for a lonesome and a last farewell. If I could beg, steal, or borrow a ticket on some ship or plane, I'd be leaving London. My own love again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tom Paxton. I hope you enjoyed that show I've done today. It's something a little bit different, and I really hope it worked. I know a little bit more. Well, I recorded. I should know something about it all, but I haven't played that tape for a long time, and it still sounds good. Thank you very much, Tom Paxton, and it's John Bartt saying thank you very much for listening to Sid Valley Radio, and I hope you did enjoy the show. I'm gonna press this button, and that'll be the end of it all. Anyway, thanks again. Keep listening to Sid Valley Radio, proper community radio. And here they come.
If you would like to contact Sid Valley Radio, we'd love to hear from you. You can message the studio from our webpage. Just go to sidvalleyradio.co.uk and follow the link on the contact page, or download our free iPhone or Android app, available from the App Store or Google Play. You can also text the studio on 07565 825 041. Or you can email the studio, studio@sidvalleyradio.co.uk. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Sid Valley Radio.